Judy Rebick supports Rabble because
Rabble's one of the very few spaces anywhere that you get a variety of views. All the new movements that emerged in Canada, whether it was Idle No More, the Maple Spring, the first place they appear is on Rabble.
Thanks, Judy. Just a few reasons to support Rabble.ca. Go to www.rabble.ca/donate.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's radio, free radio.
That grave is founded on 2/3 a person. Rapings and beatings and suffering and worsens. Black human packages tied up in strings. Black rage can come from all these kinds of things.
The F Word, Vancouver's explicitly feminist radio show, bringing you another perspective since 2007.
You are listening to The F Word. The F Word is a syndicated show produced on unceded Coast Salish territories, Vancouver, BC, Canada, at CFRO 100.5 FM, Vancouver's cooperative radio station. For more information about The F Word Media Collective, you can go to our website at feminisms.org. You can hear our shows through that site, plus coopradio.org, rabble.ca, archive.org, Pacifica Radio, and iTunes. And every week we broadcast live from East Vancouver on unceded Coast Salish territory. I'm Sarah Jo, and earlier you heard the demo track Black Rage by Lauryn Hill. She released the song in August 2014 in dedication to the people fighting for racial justice in Ferguson following the shooting of Michael Brown, an unarmed black teenager, by a white police officer, Darren Wilson. Since the shooting, there have been mass protests, die-ins, and solidarity events across North America. The recent grand jury decision not to indict Wilson for Brown's murder has only confirmed what is a reality for many people of color, but especially black people, that in the eyes of the law, their lives do not matter. On today's F Word, in honor of Martin Luther King Jr. Day in the U.S., we are sharing a recent event that took place here in Vancouver that specifically called out the academic community about their responsibility to engage in the Black Lives Matter movement. The popular Black Lives Matter hashtag was started by three black queer women of color, Alicia Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opal Tometi. We want to name their work as it is not often acknowledged or known, and we wish to honor the important work of black queer women in resisting white supremacy and police violence against people of color. Feminists have long engaged with anti-racist struggles, from Sojourner's Truth's Ain't I a Woman to the statement made by the Combahee River Collective to Kimberly Crenshaw's articulation of intersectionality that has shaped much of today's feminism. In 1964, Ella Baker, an African-American civil rights leader and organizer, stated, "Until the killing of black men, black mothers' sons, becomes as important to the rest of the country as the killing of a white mother's sons, we who believe in freedom cannot rest until this happens." Her words remind us that the Black Lives Matter movement encompasses what feminists fight for daily: mothers worrying about their children being murdered at the hands of police or vigilantes is a feminist issue. Trans women, and especially trans women of color, facing higher rates of brutality is a feminist issue. Racist portrayals of people of color in the media is a feminist issue. And obviously, the murder of black women is a feminist issue. People have been responding to anti-black racism not only through protests, but also through the creation of protest songs. Here's one called "We Ain't Gonna Stop Till the People Are Free," performed by a woman named Bria Marie, who is using YouTube as a platform for her activism.
I can hear my neighbors crying, I can't breathe. Now I'm in the struggle and I can't till people are free. Oh, I said we ain't gonna stop till people are free.
On January 9, 2015, a group of graduate students, lecturers, and faculty in literary and cultural studies put on a solidarity event and speak out at the 2015 Modern Language Association, MLA, convention. Around 200 people, almost all convention members, attended the Ferguson to MLA event. Afterwards, attendees chanted and marched throughout the convention center. Approximately 30 people were part of the planning committee and organized exclusively online. Many of them met for the first time at the convention, only coming together to address the troubling silence from their colleagues around Black Lives Matter. Today, on The F Word, we are airing the words of speakers and attendees from that event. Dr. Deborah McDowell, Dr. Caritha Mitchell, Dr. Houston Alfred Baker Jr., and co-hosts Dr. Rupika Rizam and Dr. Pranav Jani. Dr. Deborah McDowell is the Alice Griffin Professor of English and the Director of the Carter G. Woodson Institute for African American and African Studies at the University of Virginia. Dr. Caritha Mitchell is an Associate Professor of English at The Ohio State University. And Dr. Houston Alfred Baker Jr. is an American scholar specializing in African American literature at Vanderbilt University in the English department. Baker served as president of the Modern Language Association and as editor of the journal American Literature. Before we hear these speaks, here is Black Lives Matter Freedom Song by Adriana Brown, who posted this song on her YouTube channel.
This song came to me in a dream, and I wanted to share it with all of you. Freedom song, I got to sing my freedom song. I love my people, oh, I love us so. I got my freedom and I won't let go, because Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter to me. Your life matters, my life matters, Black Lives Matter to me. Freedom song, I got to sing my freedom song. I love my people, oh, I love us so. I got my freedom and I won't let go, because Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter to me. Your life matters, my life matters, Black Lives Matter to me. Freedom song, I got to sing my freedom song. I love my people, who I love us so. I got my freedom and I won't let go, because Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter to me. Your life matters, my life matters, Black Lives Matter to me.
Good afternoon, thank you for joining us today. I'm Rupika Rizam. I'm just one of many people who organized for the Ferguson to MLA Planning Committee. And before we begin our program, I just wanted to take a moment to tell you that as we worked to plan this event, we sought out collaborators and partners, both within the MLA and with local organizers, with African-American scholars, and indigenous scholars and activists. And one of the many things that we learned is that we have many things to learn. There are a number of complicated dynamics that are influencing our ability to be here today at the convention. And where we are, the land this convention is on, is on the unceded and occupied land of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish nations. And our ability to have this convention here is a direct benefit of settler colonialism. And this is not a colonial moment that is of the past, but it is a colonial moment of the present. So while our impetus for gathering here is located largely in our investment in the belief that Black Lives Matter, it's worth understanding the local context in which our convention is taking place. And this includes the significant number of missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canada, gentrification, displacement, and state violence, not only against Indigenous people, but also Black Canadians. And we are mindful that though Ferguson has brought us here, in the context of solidarity, rejecting white supremacy is an incomplete project unless we also acknowledge the influence that it has in Canada. And our presence here. So just to give you a brief explanation of what we're going to do. We're going to have Pranav Jani from Ohio State University doing a welcome. Then we're going to have a 4.5 a minute moment of silence in remembrance of the 4.5 hours that Michael Brown's body lay in the street. Then we'll have speakers, and I'll introduce the speakers shortly. And then if you would like to come up and give a very brief statement, an offering about why Black Lives Matter, why our gathering here is important in the context of our work as scholars and as teachers, please then when the confirmed speakers start, just make your way up towards here, and we can facilitate an open mic. So I'm going to introduce you to Pranav, who will take it over from here.
Thanks so much, Rupika. Thanks to all of you for coming out. This is amazing. Thanks to the planning committee that worked for the last 3 weeks. Most of us met today and yesterday, face to face. On the 23rd, we were on Skype calls, and on the 31st, we were writing up statements. And thanks to all your dedication. I'll read the statement that we drafted together and present that right now. So since August 2014, we have witnessed the most sustained, widespread grassroots activism against anti-Black racism and police brutality in the United States since the 1960s and 1970s. Through teach-ins, community gatherings, marches, and die-ins, by taking actions to halt business as usual, blocking highways, bridges, and access to malls and other spaces, Black people and other people of color have taken the lead in challenging the status quo. Their voice is clear, end racist police murders, and fundamentally transform the justice system that favors and facilitates this violence. The current state of things cannot continue. We've planned this action at MLA, first and foremost, to bring together all colleagues and scholars who stand in solidarity with these ongoing struggles. We affirm that Black lives matter. We are angered by the state's complete disregard for Black lives, quite visible in these murders of Black women and men, and the impunity of the cops who killed them. But this devaluation is also structural. It's present in the continued denial of economic justice and the limited access to education, healthcare, housing, and other social goods. As a group of mostly U.S. academics, in addition, we seek to make links to local activists in Vancouver, including indigenous rights groups in their struggle against state violence. Secondly, this action contributes to debates in the MLA about our involvement in politics and political struggle. We affirm that the time is now for scholars to connect our research and teaching with real struggles in the world. We can no longer be silent. We cannot tacitly sanction the status quo that's allowed our colleges, universities, and professional organizations to become increasingly segregated along racial lines, even as African American, Africana, and other ethnic studies departments and programs have fallen victim to the crisis in the academy. It's time to decide whether we actually will make our universities and our disciplines open and accessible to Black people and other people of color, or whether we will simply reflect and contribute to the segregation and accelerating inequalities around us. The Ferguson to MLA action aims to open space for such a dialogue and to share resources for academics to get involved in the ongoing movements on their own campuses and in their own cities. We invite people of all backgrounds to participate in and shape the event, and we believe very strongly that Black people and other people of color ought to be central and visible at every step of the process and at the event itself. This was written before. Please help spread the word, and clearly you have. In solidarity, Ferguson to MLA Planning Committee. Thank you.
Is Amit here? We're going to move on now to the speaker portion of our event. And so just to remind you that after our confirmed speakers have spoken, I will invite anybody who would like to come and speak for the open mic session to come up. Our first speaker is Dr. Deborah McDowell, Alice Griffin Professor of English and Director of the Carter G. Woodson Institute for African American and African Studies at the University of Virginia.
For coming. I've been receiving my instructions as I just arrived. I had drafted a few remarks to which I will add at the end a statement drafted with colleagues at the University of Virginia in the face of the Mike Brown case as well as the Eric Garner case in Staten Island. Give me a second. The protests we have been witnessing in Ferguson and beyond over the days and months since Michael Brown was gunned down in cold blood, in broad daylight, constitutes the practice of everyday life for countless numbers of black folk, though most often their protests go unheard. Whether quarantined in the Fergusons of the United States or in the proliferating pockets of urban sprawl, or even, perhaps especially, in the gated communities, black folk are daily reminded that not only are our lives judged cheap and valueless, but that they can be taken at whim and with impunity. I have little to add here that hasn't already been amply, eloquently, and compellingly stated about the incidents in Ferguson and Staten Island, particularly as regards the makeshift frames, the shop-worn taxonomies, the culture's shorthand, as well as the disciplinary tactics and technologies it summons endlessly to make sense of events each time a black person, especially a black male, is killed at the hands of a white person, resisting arrest, threatening, charging, raging, gang-banging, gang-signaling, criminal record, no angel. These are the quick trips our journalists and pundits make to the cultural lexicon to explain and explain away each new shot, each new chokehold, each new rifle supposedly raised in threat. My remarks, then, you should know, constitute a synthesis of many accounts that we have all devoured voraciously since Michael Brown's death, since Eric Brown's death, and the travesty of justice in their aftermath. As many have observed, Michael Brown's name must be inserted into a lengthening line of murdered victims, all killed by whites, though not all at the hands of police, all over this country. Eleanor Bumpers, the Bronx, Yusuf Hawkins, Bensonhurst, Michael Griffith, Queens, Sean Bell, Queens, Oscar Grant, Oakland, Renisha McBride, Dearborn Heights, Michigan, Jordan Davis, Jacksonville, Florida, Eric Garner, Staten Island, John Crawford III, Beaver Creek, Ohio, and the list could go on and on of those known and unknown. And at the end of the day, efforts to account for their murders ultimately end up criminalizing the victims and flattening the complexities surrounding their deaths. As each in this shuffling list of names and places establishes plainly, we have been here before. Although my own truncated list might extend much further backwards in space and time, so as to include the lives lost in Tulsa, Oklahoma, 1921, Rosewood, Florida, 1923, Harlem in 1935 and 43, Watts, 1965. To recall these times and places should not be taken as an idle or cheap shot, which risks performing its own act of oversimplification by seeming to collapse one eruption into another. And yet we all know that the events of Ferguson must be situated along this historical continuum, must be understood to be a lineal descendant of them all. In other words, these are all branches from the same root. Now, I was asked if I would read a statement, as I indicated, drafted with some of my colleagues, and so I will cut short these remarks and read that statement so as allow for others to come forward. Last week, and this was in the immediate aftermath of the grand jury's decision regarding Eric Garner. Last week, we, the faculty, affiliates, and fellows of the Carter G. Woodson Institute for African American and African Studies at the University of Virginia stood in shock and solidarity with those throughout the world who were deeply aggrieved and outraged by the decision of the grand jury in the case of Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson, that Wilson could repeatedly shoot and ultimately kill Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed African-American youth, in the open light of day, and not be required by law to account for his actions, remains patently incomprehensible and unjust. Still reeling from that news, which underscored how little Black lives matter to many, we learned yesterday, less than a week later, that a New York grand jury declined to indict Officer Daniel Pantaleo in the murder of unarmed Eric Garner, choked to death last August in Staten Island. It is impossible here to speak the names of the many thousands gone who constitute this ever-lengthening chain of corpses, some I've already named: Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, Chantel Davis, Tarika Wilson, Sean Bell, Amadou Diallo, Rikia Boyd, John Crawford, some left to draw their last breaths on the cold concrete slabs of city streets. We stand then with citizens around the globe in condemning this wanton disregard for the sanctity of these and other Black lives, treated cavalierly, taken with impunity, and rationalized through appeals to grotesque legal technicalities. Such technicalities can neither mask the virulent racism nor suppress the evidence of the deeply flawed legal apparatus of the state that sanctions such murderous force and smothers human rights. As a teaching and research collective, and you are all members of similar teaching and research collectives, comprised of fellows, professors from various disciplinary backgrounds, history, politics, economics, sociology, law, and other humanistic and social sciences, we decry efforts to extract the events in Ferguson, Staten Island, Cleveland, Beaver Creek, and beyond from a centuries-long history of state-sponsored violence against Black and brown people, from a history of racialized and ritualized violence in the U.S. and abroad. As educators, we pledge to expose the historical roots and persistent ravages of racism, unmask the structures that foster and reproduce it, and fight the misuse and abuse of power wherever it rises up to choke the lives of citizens, whenever it rises up to smother freedom, democracy, and social justice. Thank you very much.
You're tuning in to The F Word, and today on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we are airing speaks from a recent event, the 2015 Modern Language Association, MLA, convention that took place in Vancouver that specifically called out the academic community about their responsibility to engage in the Black Lives Matter movement. Earlier, you heard Dr. Pranav Jani and Dr. Deborah McDowell speak. We will continue airing pieces from the Ferguson to MLA solidarity event with addresses given by Dr. Caritha Mitchell and Dr. Houston Baker Jr. But first, you'll be hearing the song Black Lives Matter by Nehi. This song is all about the Black Lives Matter movement and the protests in Los Angeles, California. Nehi was arrested on November 25, 2014 in downtown Los Angeles during one of the Los Angeles Police Department's infamous mass arrest operations of protesters protesting police brutality and killings, known for her work as one part of the all-female rap group Da Five Footas, Martin used that experience to pen a song about the LAPD, police brutality, and being arrested.
Jabbed out, watched the beat on innocent people cause they didn't like what was said. Took a man off the bike and knocked another in the head. Yeah, that's some bullshit. And I'll say it again. I stand behind my folks that's protesting. LA to Ferguson, I'm on that rah-rah. Cause the police shooting people on that blah-blah shit. Snatch you in a chokehold and let me see what you do. Choke it out until your face turn blue. Yeah, I said it. Had me in zip ties for hours. Kettled on the cul-de-sac. Yeah, went down like that. No dispersed warning, but all under arrest. Don't make one move and you'll get shot in your chest. Felt like a movie, but not it was real. Wanna be off for Thanksgiving, gotta post the bill.
Next, we will have Dr. Caritha Mitchell, who's this? Did I say that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's an associate professor of English at Ohio State University.
Thank you all for being here. I'm really struck by the importance of our gathering, period. I'm struck by the importance of us acknowledging what's going on and coming together to share in that acknowledgement. I see this as an embodied practice of belonging, and it matters to me that you're here to participate in it, in whatever way you're here to participate in it. Now, I've been studying violence my entire adult life, and I'm real clear on what it is and its purpose. The purpose of violence is to mark who belongs and who does not. The reason why we know clearly that that's its purpose is because this is why people who are victimized and part of marginalized communities are blamed for the violence that they experience. And this is why perpetrators, if they represent the status quo in any way, are always seen as justified. So this mechanism of teaching us who belongs and who does not is at the heart of everything that we're experiencing. So in this, and I'm talking about the United States, racist, sexist, heterosexist, classist, ableist, aggressively and perhaps ironically Christian nation, that means that this is the pattern that you're going to see. Now, I can't address all of the implications and everything that I've been thinking about, obviously. So I actually think I want to talk in really general terms about violence. So first, violence itself as kind of a physical act is a denial of citizenship. And when I say citizenship, I'm just talking about this idea of belonging, okay? So that physical act says that I can do this to you because I don't have to care about your life and limb. And then when that violent act becomes public and the response to it is apathy or victim blaming, then that means that the violence, both physical and discursive, has now become a public performance, right? So the message is, this is a person, these are people who do not belong. They are not valued by or valuable to a collective that matters. We need to get very clear about that being the result of these public performances denying the citizenship of entire populations. And so understanding that has made me very aware of the need to remind myself and others that we should think about violence actually as know your place aggression. The message is you need to know your place. You think you can take up space here? You think you belong? You think you can assert that you belong? Let me remind you of your proper place. And it feels to me like if we really understood what it means to think about it as know your place aggression, if we really understood that it's really success that beckons the mob, it's success that invites this aggression, then we wouldn't be so caught up in trying to tell victimized communities, well, if you would behave this way, things would be a little bit better. We need to get clear about how it's your success that brings this aggression. So it seems to me that part of what dealing with success as something that's inviting this into my life, part of what that's meant for me to really grapple with is think about coalition, think about solidarity. Because those of you who know me on Facebook and Twitter probably won't believe me when I say that I've been silenced by what's been happening. All invitations to radio programs, I've turned them down. And this has helped me to realize how much I was letting it silence me. This is how much it made me realize, right? I'm not Superwoman. This black skin doesn't make me impervious to the messages that my nation continues to send to me, right? That I don't belong, that I don't deserve this space. But again, I want to mark the importance of embodied practices of belonging, because that's what had me thinking about coalition. In Columbus, Ohio, a lot of the actions that we've taken have actually been organized partly by my colleague and brother, Pranav Jani. And one of the activities that I partook in, we had this chant that said, "Whose streets are streets? Whose streets are streets?" And I immediately began crying and unable to utter those words, because it was clear to me that I didn't believe these were my streets. It was clear to me that everything that's been happening is to make me understand that public space is simply not meant for me and mine. And so as the people around me were shouting those words, I really felt and understood that I had gotten a really crucial, crucial message. But I also understood how much it meant to me that the people around me were making that assertion. But then it also took me to how easy it was for some of the people around me to believe that assertion, that they weren't being constantly bombarded with the message that they don't belong. But what that made me think about then and feel in the moment was how much energy I got from being surrounded by people of every background who were saying that. Whose streets are streets? I got emboldened and took the energy from that. So what I'm struck by, right, is how much these public performances of denying other people's citizenship, they do hit us differently. But we need to make that a tool that we can use, right? So when I'm in retreat, Pranav has been energized. When he needs a break, Lenora and Rupika have been able to kind of rise up. So if it is the case that this isn't hitting some people as hard as it's hitting me, that needs to be a bridge builder. I need to take from that, and we can all take from that, because that's to me what coalition has come to mean through this experience, what solidarity has come to mean. I need your energy. And this brought that home for me, because I actually said to Pranav, I don't want to speak. And it made me realize I'm letting myself be silenced again. So please don't underestimate what you bring to this struggle. So maybe we can think in terms of whose space, our space. Whose space, our space. Whose space, our space. And that can be in whatever space we need to reclaim. Thank you.
From Ferguson to MLA, Black Lives Matter.
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 From Ferguson to MLA,
let's welcome our next speaker for the open mic.
Okay, so I just want to step up again quickly to really mark visibly, and I hope that other people will mark it too, but just in case, mark visibly that Black Lives Matter as a hashtag was started by queer people of color, and that we need to understand that that's part of the legacy that we're talking here about here. When I talk about all marginalized groups and know your place aggression, this is also coming out of my understanding of the degree to which anti-LGBT violence is very similar to what I understand lynching to have done and achieved. And so just want to make sure that we make that explicit. That's very much a part of the logic here, but I'd love to hear more voices on that.
My name is Amber Riaz, and I approach you today with intense fear. I am a Pakistani Muslim mother, and I'm here only because they are murdering my children. They are killing my men. And thank you for opening up the space for all identities. Thank you for accepting all identities, because Black Lives Matter.
I, like Caritha had said, there were people far more qualified, younger for sure, and able-bodied than I to speak at this gathering. The sense from what you have heard articulated speaks to both continuities of repression and oppression and silences and absences and legitimization and delegitimization that marks an institutional history and indeed a national and a transnational history of this planet. Now, there's nothing worse than having someone of my, well, I think decorous, you know, but indecorous age get up and begin to talk about these are my experiences and this is what has happened and so forth. But we live in memory. The theme is sites of memory. And the first MLA that my wife and I attended was in 1968. And I told an anecdote to Caritha of the man behind me on the elevator, tall, not a man of color, who tapped me on the shoulder and wondered if I knew where he could find any good colored boys to come and teach in Texas. Well, I thought, well, Texas, no, but, you know. But I don't know any colored boys either, so, you know, I was kind of completely powerless in the face of the inquiry. But since this probably does, almost certainly does, mark the last MLA I will soldier forward to at the end of the holidays and so forth, and since I've been president in the past of the Modern Language Association and been in councils that have lasted to 4 or 5 a.m. in the morning as we try to stress points of freedom, emancipation, diversity, and so forth, and have told certain of my colleagues who go on and soldier on that all I had to do was look at the way they voted and I would vote just the opposite. If you know Booker T. Washington, you know how that all resonates, right? So that it seems to me that an organization that has boasted the likes of an H. Bruce Franklin, a Louis Comte, posters, placards, protests throughout its history, but at the same time, if one goes back retro to the 19th century, said, this is not your place. No black people here. Very few women, if any, here. And it wasn't until, actually, I mean, the coalescence of the historical with the present, insofar as it was Barbara Smith and her large constituency who walked into the halls of the old Americana Hotel and said, we're here, we're quit, we're not, we're queer, we're going nowhere, change shit, right? Okay? And through her work and the work of so many countless others, to the point of exhaustion, right? The institution has great opportunities for its present and future. David's on the executive council. my colleague Tracy Deneen Sharpley Whiting is on the council, and just looking at the assembled body here today and its interests that are legion means that within the structures of this institution, there is every opportunity to, as the old hymn has it, be not afraid. Be not afraid. I'll end with what my late colleague Addison Gale said to me when I was aspiring rigorously bourgeois fashion after the progenitor Houston A. Baker Sr., who told me how to do everything. I didn't say he taught me. I said he told me how to to do everything. And one of those was, if you have your act together, if you have courage, if you're willing to work your fingers to the bone, you may get a chance to do something. And then switching quickly to Stuart Scott, who some of you surely know, booyah, right? Who stood on that stage after fighting cancer for 7 years. And he said, death doesn't matter. It's not how you die. It's how you live that counts. I'm not afraid of death, right? The thing is what you leave behind as a legacy that is extraordinarily important. And my friend Addison Gale said, when I said to him, but Addison, man, if you keep on writing this stuff about the black aesthetic and saying that, you know, imagine this, the Fugitive Poets, I'll Take My Stand, is the second most racist and horrible document since Mein Kampf. I said, you can't write stuff like that and get tenure. He said, Houston, old man, I never, ever expected to be in one of these places. Tenure doesn't matter. I have a chance and I have resources to be articulate and to speak to the world, and I'm going to do it until I die. And this is just such a heartening gathering at this point. Historical, just eloquent, elegant and eloquent, and I am so happy to be a part of it. So I thank you. We can't breathe.
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 And when you think about being free, you know, when we saw the G20 happen here, we saw the, and we saw when Occupy was on, we saw the lockdown in the city. So I think we really have to think about freedom in a very wide sense as a people. And we have to think about that globally and locally. What does it mean to really be free? So,
waiting on release, I feel like I'm on a leash. There's a piano we can use. And all I want to do is sing the blues. There's a weight in the gym we can't use to get trim. A library full of books where we cannot even look. Just walking in a cage, feeling like a slave.
You're tuned into The F Word, and you just heard I Wanna Be Free by Faith Nolan and the All Women's Blues Band. Faith Nolan is a Canadian social activist and singer-songwriter. Before that, you heard Speaks from a recent Black Lives Matter solidarity event, which took place at the 2015 Modern Language Association MLA convention in Vancouver. Thank you so much for tuning in to The F Word today on Martin Luther King Jr. Day as we affirm that Black Lives Matter.
The F Word, Vancouver's explicitly feminist radio show, effing up the airwaves since 2007.